Thanks, Juan, and thanks everyone for coming, and thanks very much for inviting me. It's a big pleasure. I will talk today about work done with these collaborators. The one in the top row are grad students. Let's see, as you know, we now have these interferometers that measure gravitational waves. These waves are emitted by a compact binary object as it orbits each other. This emission of gravitational waves carries away energy. This energy brings the orbit, shrinks the orbit, makes the gravitational wave emission louder. And this process then is a runaway that ends with a merger. It is that with these very large interferometers, we can detect gravitational waves. And by looking at the detailed shape of these waveforms in the data, we can constrain what the parameters of the compact objects are. Now, the after the data is taken, the way this happens is that there's a proprietary period, a year and a half, in which the LIGO and Virgo collaboration do their analysis and publish results. After this proprietary period, the data becomes public, and that's where those of us who are not in the collaboration can also take a look. And the data analysis of gravitational waves involves roughly three stages in a hierarchy. The first step is, of course, to search for signals. Then the second step is, once you identify a signal, you want to know what the parameters of the source of that signal are, things like masses, spins, sky location, etc. And there's a third stage. Once you have many signals detected whose parameters you characterize, you ask questions like, what is the distribution of masses in the universe? What is the distribution of spins, and so on? Of course, there's things one can do, like testing general relativity and so on. But these three are the ones that I have worked on. And today I won't talk about search, but I will talk about parameter estimation and the second part of the talk about the astrophysical population inference. So for parameter estimation, these binary black holes have 15 parameters, at least quasi-circular binary black holes have 15 parameters. 8 of them are intrinsic, 2 masses and 6 spins. And the remaining ones are extrinsic, things like time of arrival, direction of arrival, orientation, so on. Out of these 15, however, not all of them can be measured. In practice, about 10 of these parameters or combinations of these parameters can be measured. And what in practice this means is that the posterior distribution for these parameters will have large degeneracies, meaning that you can get two different sets of parameters that give the same waveform or very similar waveform in the data, so you cannot tell those two apart. In addition, some of these degeneracies are discrete. So it can happen that there's no way to connect continuously these two solutions while preserving the degeneracy. And an example of both of these effects is shown here. So for example, you see this banana-like shape correspond to continuous degeneracies. And the also in some panels, you can see there's islands. Like in this one, there's 4 islands that are correspond to discrete degeneracies. And both these nonlinear degeneracies and the multimodality make it computationally much harder to explore this distribution. So since these are high dimensional parameter spaces, the most efficient way of describing the distribution is by giving samples of the distribution. And this is done by some generic algorithms, which, given the ability to evaluate the probability density, explore the space and return samples from the distribution. And these sampler algorithms often have trouble if you have degeneracies and multimodality. So in this first part of the talk, I will describe a change of coordinates that sends this distribution to one that looks much simpler. You can see here that all these bananas and islands have been removed. And we have the sampler explore this problem. And this makes it more robust and more efficient. And this is, I'm stressing, this is just a change of coordinates. So both the left and right hand side are the same samples expressing different coordinates.
Now, here's just a question. So is that a generic statement or it depends on the size of the island you create after you do whatever computation? Right? Imagine if I have it quick, but it's small, and then I do my things in terms of other variables. Now I have a very distinctive island, but it's huge. So now it looks more amenable.
So the statement, are you asking about the statement that the islands are gone?
No, I'm saying, is it always the case that if you train islands for multiple islands, or single island, but larger, is it always the case that it's going to be more efficient?
So I think the scale is not a problem because the samplers are scale-free in some way. They have a way of estimating the standard deviation and rescale their own coordinates by that. So that's thing. The general statement is the more your distribution looks like a Gaussian, no matter if it's a big or small Gaussian, the sampler will find it easier than if it has some shape. Okay, so next is how can we come up with this coordinate system that I'm just showing the result. So the idea is to identify how is it that the data constrains the parameters. This is through the likelihood function. The likelihood function depends on how the waveform looks at the detectors, right? And at least for the extrinsic parameters, the effect, or the under some approximations, the leading effect of the extrinsic parameters is to change the amplitude, phase, and time of arrival at the detectors. And furthermore, we have formulas for this amplitude, phase, and time of arrival. So for example, the amplitude, there is some dependence on the intrinsic parameters, but it's very simple in that heavier sources are louder. But then this is inversely proportional to the luminosity distance to the source, and also depends on the response of the detector to that particular sky location and inclination. And this detector response, in reality, is a complex number, so it also contributes a phase together with the orbital phase, and there's a projection of the time of arrival is partly degenerate with this phase, so you can remove this. And then the time of arrival at each detector is first some global time of arrival at Earth, but there's also a contribution from the time delay because gravitational waves travel at the speed of light. And these time delays depend on the sky location. So then the idea is, so on the right-hand side here are all the physical parameters that we are will be interested in. For example, the sky location in coordinates that the astronomers like. And on the left-hand side are the quantities that are actually measured by the detector. So then the idea will be pick a coordinate system that instead of emphasizing these coordinates, emphasizes these quantities. And if we can come up with a coordinate system that in which these quantities as best as we can describe it independently. And this has a simple Jacobian, then we can use that coordinate system instead. So for the amplitude, for example, the first thing we can do is another thing is that this amplitude, phase, and time are better measured the louder the SNR is. So we can sort the detectors by the SNR that they have. So we'll call the first or reference detector is the one with the loudest SNR in which these parameters are better measured, and the second detector, so on. We can define, for example, a rescaled version of the distance that's rescaled by this quantity here that depends on the remaining parameters. And we construct this in such a way that it's basically the amplitude measured by at the detector. And the effect here, you can see here, in terms of the luminosity distance is correlated with, in this case, sky location. But this d hat thing is not. So these plots are the same samples, just expressed in terms of the L luminosity distance, or in the top row, or this d hat quantity that is rescaled. So you see that this d hat doesn't have the large correlations with sky location that luminosity distance has.
What
this has a shape of a blob and this has the shape of a banana. Yeah. So if you are a sampler and you want to explore this distribution, then either your jumps need to be more complicated or it will just be less efficient. Okay. While if you're a sampler and want to explore this one, it will be more efficient. In a similar way, instead of using the overall time of arrival at the center of the Earth, it's just better to use the time of arrival at the reference detector, because now that's the thing that's actually measured. And you see that the time of arrival at the center of the Earth has a large correlation with these sky location parameters, whereas at the reference detector does not. If you have more than one detector, then each pair of detectors measures a time delay. And this time delay defines a ring in the sky that's consistent with this time of arrival. And then this ring in the sky is not aligned with right ascension and declination in any particular way. And also how it translates to right ascension and declination depends on the rotation of the Earth. So if you plot for all the events what the sky location looks like, you get this plot. But this ring has a very simple description if you pick your axis so that the z-axis is in the line joining the two detectors. And then the ring of time delay is of constant zenithal angle theta. So we just define this coordinate system that using your two loudest detectors. Here is what the posteriors look like, which is much easier to explore again. And this is a coordinate system that, of course, rotates with the Earth. And then finally, there's a phase and the reference detector. So here, what we do is that the phase, if you remember the formula, the phase at the reference detector is the orbital phase, or twice the orbital phase, plus some extra phase that depends on the response of the detector. What we can do is, first, before sampling, we maximize the likelihood, find what is the best fit phase of arrival at the reference detector. And then, while we are sampling, as a function of the remaining parameters, we can predict what is the orbital phase my signal should have in order to match this maximum likelihood phase I already measured. And then I describe the orbital phase in terms of departures from this best fit orbital phase. The expression is this, but what it means is we are exploring the difference between the orbital phase and the best fit phase. And you see this, then this difference is expected to have a peak at zero because zero is the best fit. And we see already in this case, so the correlation is removed. This parameter is much better measured. But one interesting thing is that there's a second peak at pi. And this is because, you know, the as long as the gravitational wave signal is quadrupolar, then you can rotate the two black holes by pi, and then you get the same gravitational wave out. If the signal has higher harmonics, then this symmetry is not perfect, and this is why you know, these two peaks are not exactly the same. But this is the reason why there's two peaks. So this brings us to multimodality. This is the first example of multimodality. But then we see a different example. So far, I've defined these four quantities that control the amplitude, the phase, the time of arrival at the reference detector, and the time of arrival at the second best detector. And since these are quantities that are very well measured, then typically these four parameters in blue are well measured. However, unless you have some extra effects like a third detector or higher modes or something that you know, breaks this degeneracy, then the idea is that the effect of the remaining parameters in the likelihood is very small. And then if anything, these parameters are constrained by the prior, usually. And how they enter the prior is through this prior in d hat that has some Jacobian to the luminosity distance. And this Jacobian depends on the detector response. So all in all, the prior for these parameters is like the detector response absolute value Q. And this detector response has four peaks as a function of inclination and sky location. Recall, phi net is the azimuth of the sky location in the ring. Okay, and these four peaks are the following. If the source is phase on or phase off, it emits more gravitational waves, so you can put it further out. And this is favored by the prior. And then if you put it overhead of the detector or underfoot the detector, also the detector has more response and similar thing. So this produces typically four peaks in the posterior. I'm showing here four events. You see, for three of them, all four peaks are present. And I also put one example in which they are not. This is just to stress that this is an approximate symmetry, that you can interchange phase on for phase off or overhead by underfoot. But for example, this event has three detectors and higher modes, so it breaks this degeneracy. Still, it's quite generic that you will find these four modes. And as I said in the beginning, this is a problem for samplers. But the good thing is that we already know in advance kind of where these modes will be. So can we use this knowledge? And the trick that we use is, now this is the posterior of only one event. I just painted by hand the four islands in different colors. The trick is, instead of sampling the full distribution in the full space, we just sample a modified distribution in a portion of the space. And this modified distribution is the sum of these four islands appropriately reflected, so that they land on top of each other. And we slightly you know, tweak our coordinates so that these are just simple one-parameter reflections. And then just sum these probabilities and use a traditional sampler to sample this distribution, which is unimodal. And then in post-processing, if we remember what were the four numbers that we summed in order to get this, we can reconstruct the full distribution after we have done the sampling. So with all these tricks, after the folding and the coordinate transformation, this is how we retrieve this this distribution. And it also the uncertainties agree much better with theoretical expectations. Now, the result is that there's an improvement both in performance and in robustness. So now, okay, what this plot is showing is, without using any of these tricks I explained, just repeat parameter estimation for the same event, increasing this number of live points, which is just a property of the sampler. But you can think that the more live points you use, the more expensive it will be, but the better the sampler will explore this space. And you see that, in fact, unless you use a very high number of live points, you never find all the modes. And even when you do, they don't all have the correct weights, like this one is undersampled. While if you use the folding and the coordinates, these problems go away. And this plot is showing basically the error in the retrieval of the posterior as a function of runtime and all, as we increase the number of live points. And you see that you get a much better curve if you do folding and coordinates. And in order to get a comparable thing to this, you need to wait over 100 hours as opposed to 1 hour.
So the error is with respect to some injected signal?
Okay, the definition I'm using for the error is it's the Jensen-Shannon divergence between, let's say, one posterior and my best reference posterior, which by definition I choose to be like this run with most live points. So the last point here is zero by definition. So it's a bit cheating, but you see that this is converging very well. So there's a public code that performs parameter estimation using all these coordinates and the folding. And this is here. It's called Cogwheel. And please, if anything or any of this is useful, please use it. And if you need help, I'm happy to do that. Okay. So far, this was all extrinsic parameters. Now let's talk a bit about intrinsic parameters. The first advice or choice is let's think about how the intrinsic parameters affect the waveform. And we can distinguish between two main effects. One is that of the aligned spins, that is the components that are parallel to the orbital angular momentum, and then the in-plane spins that are perpendicular. And the leading effect of aligned spins is to change the rate of orbital evolution. And the first parameter that enters in the expansion is something very similar to this effective spin, which is an average of the two spins mass weighted and projected on the direction of the orbit. Of the two aligned spin components, then you can combine them into this parameter that is much better constrained than either of the two components. So we advocate for using this as a sampling coordinate. Then regarding the in-plane spins, the effect of the in-plane spins in the waveform is to produce precession of the orbital plane. This means the orbital plane precesses basically around the direction of the total angular momentum. Let me just show a video instead. So this is a simulation done by Vijay Varma and collaborators of a precessing black hole. So you see that the spins are not aligned with the orbit, and the orbital angular momentum, this red arrow, is changing in time. And then the direction of emission of gravitational waves is mainly along this L and minus L. So at the detector, what you would see is some modulation of the signal that is louder whenever L is pointing towards you, and fainter whenever it's pointing at 90 degrees. Good. So the way this precession then is measured is through the detection of these amplitude modulations in the spiral. And the first tip that already people suggested a long time ago is that it's best to define the initial conditions for the spins, to specify the spins, at the middle of the detector band where the signal is being measured very loud. Because an alternative option that people sometimes do is specify the spins early on before the signal enters the detection band. But then to like how the spins are measured here is by extrapolating back the spins at the higher frequency. And this extrapolation back then depends on the masses and quantities that you have to measure. So if you have an error bar there, this error bar propagates to the spin as well.
Usually, what's the reference frequency?
Order 100 hertz, it depends for the a bit on the mass of the signal. So for lighter binaries, you can go a bit higher, and for heavier binaries, you can go a bit lower, but that's the order of magnitude where the detector is more sensitive. It doesn't depend on the details, if you pick 100 or 90 or 80 hertz, it's the same, but just 20 is too low. Then the second advice is that there's two choices in the literature for specifying the the azimuth of these spins. So once typically the z-axis is chosen as either the orbital angular momentum or the total angular momentum. So one choice is to choose the orbital angular momentum as the z-axis, and then you need a second axis in the plane to find the zero of the azimuth. One choice is to use the orbital separation vector at some reference frequency and measure the spins from there. The second relevant vector is the direction to the detector. And in this case, you would also specify the direction to the detector relative to the orbital separation vector. So for some reason, it's pi over 2 minus that. But, basically, so in this framework, they use the orbital separation vector to specify both the direction to the detector and the spin. There's an alternative choice in which you specify the azimuth of the spin or the equivalently the orbital angular momentum with respect to this direction to the detector and regardless of the orbital separation. So I will argue that this choice is much better. And the reason is that we saw that the effect of this precession is the amplitude modulations depending on how L is pointed relative to N. So then this is directly controlled by this spin azimuth. And these amplitude modulations have nothing to do with the orbital evolution. So this orbital evolution cares about the fast phase of the wave, not the amplitude modulations. It can happen. We saw before that this orbital phase has some large correlation with other parameters like the polarization. So it can happen that even if you can measure these amplitude modulations, you cannot measure the orbital phase. And then your uncertainty in the orientation of the spins becomes dominated by the uncertainty in the orbital separation vector at the reference frequency and not your uncertainty on the direction of the spins. So this phi JL is better than phi 1, okay? And there's an extra idea that is the following. I said that gravitational waves are emitted along L or minus L. equally. So this means that if you imagine, now here is a real detector. If you imagine another detector in the antipode of the source, whenever L is pointing towards N, also minus N will get a large signal. So in that sense, there's a degeneracy between N and minus N. So if you change the location of the detector to the antipode, the only thing that changes is that a right-handed wave goes to a left-handed wave. And if you have a single detector or two colliding detectors, you cannot tell those two things apart. So that's an extra degeneracy. So we just pick this modified spin azimuth that whenever this inclination angle is, you know, bigger than 90 degrees, we add pi so that both n and minus n have the same value of this phi hat. Okay, after we do this, it turns out that this phi hat can be measured surprisingly well for several events. And the direction, so recall this is an azimuth between the direction of the spin and the direction to the detector. So it has no astrophysical interest per se. So this is why I'm centering them all at zero by hand.
So this is measured at the reference frequency?
At the reference frequency, yes. Order 100 hertz. So what is interesting is not the value, but the fact that we can measure it. And the argument is the following. If the spins were aligned with the orbit, then this azimuth doesn't do anything, and all values of azimuth would be equally allowed. So if your posterior is consistent with being aligned spins, then all values of the azimuth should at least be in your posterior. If you can manage to completely rule out some extreme value of this azimuth, then it would mean that the source is inconsistent with aligned spins. So this suggested that we can measure spin precession in some individual events. And this is very interesting for astrophysics because we have roughly two classes of formation channels for binary black holes that we would like to tell apart. One is dynamical formation, in which these binaries are assembled in many body interactions in dense environments like globular clusters or nuclear clusters. But as the result of this process, since it brings together black holes formed independently, there's a strong prediction that the spin distribution should be isotropic. Whereas there's another formation channel that's called isolated formation, in which the binary black hole eventually comes from a binary star that does some common envelope phase and things and ends up forming a black hole. Now, in this second case, there's events like mass transfer or tides and things that can align the spins. So it is expected that the spins would be aligned. So then the fact that we can measure the spin misalignment is very interesting for telling these two apart.
Sorry, this is not related to the phi JL.
Sorry, forget about this. But I'm saying the phi JLs, this suggests that we can measure spin misalignment in some cases.
Go back to the plot. So phi JL is the angle between
the total spin. The total spin about J.
So
L, which is you know, at pi, and you get the spin.
So why? So you have a lot of many events. Why is this distribution not uniform?
I center it by hand. So for each event, I measure the average and I subtract it. This is because this value, like you said, it's uniform. It doesn't bring any information. It's just where the detector is located relative to the source. So the argument I want to make with this figure is that the fact that we can measure it. So the distribution for each event, at least for some events, it's very inconsistent with the uniform order.
So the spin alignment related to the
theta JL,
that the other angle?
Well, yes. Yes, but I guess the new, or the way I phrase it, this result is the parameter that we can measure very well that we were not expecting to find this is this spin azimuth. And the argument would be, okay, if you completely can rule out that some value of phi is occurring, then the source is inconsistent with aligned spin. Of course, you know, for some of these events, there's a tail that goes to high value. So I can't say for sure for all of these events, but perhaps the few.
So, I remember I saw a talk from Savo. Scoop, they were trying to measure some phi, probably some phi. I don't know whether it's phi JL or some other phi.
Right.
And the measurement of that angle can be used to infer the formation channel of the value.
Right. This is a very similar, I think, line of argument. Unless you're saying the phi between the two spins, phi 1, 2.
I'm not sure whether they're using the same coordinates as this or the other choice.
Yeah, there's a paper by Vijay Varma and others, including Salvo. Maybe you're referring to that one. And yes, I think they get a similar result with a similar argument, except they phrase it in terms of the other spin azimuth as opposed to this one. And if you use this one, then these constraints are much stronger. So these posteriors are much more peaked than in terms of the other spin azimuth. That's why we suggest using this one.
Anything about the angle between spins and the orbital angular momentum?
Not from this plot, but I have this plot. Should I?
No, you don't.
I can show it after. That plot is also very interesting. And you see that for these events. Some of these events, like half of them, you can rule out that L is parallel to S. Yeah. Maybe I should have included that plot here too. Great. So, okay, this is then one line of argument that favors that some spins are misaligned, so this is very interesting. Then we show a different line of argument that we show that, on the other hand, isotropic distribution is not favored by the data. And this second argument is simpler. It's just look at the aligned spin component. And then if the spin distribution is symmetric, is isotropic, then the aligned spin distribution should be symmetric out zero. While in the isolated formation, it should be mostly positive. So there's these very simple predictions that these channels make. One case, the distribution should be positive, and the other one should be symmetric. And we can try to test those. Let's see. The first most basic question we can ask the data is, are all the spins consistent with being zero in truth? And just any departure from zero that we measure is due to noise fluctuations. So in order to answer that question, we do a cumulative histogram of this quantity, which is for each event, take the mean chi effective and divide by the uncertainty, the standard deviation. So under the approximation that the likelihood is Gaussian in chi effective, then since we are rescaling by the width, then this should follow the cumulative of a normal, standard normal distribution. And we see that this fits the data quite well if we say that 20 out of these 30 events I'm including actually come from zero. But there's this excess of 10, roughly 10 binaries with a positive spin. And this excess is completely inconsistent with all of them being actually zero. On the other hand, there's no similar excess on the negative spin side. That's a first observation. So that, does this immediately mean that there's more positive spin events with in nature? No, and the reason is quite subtle, that events with positive spin emit louder gravitational waves than those with negative spin. The effect is that the positive spins acts in the post-Newtonian expansion acts like a repulsive force between the black holes, and this delays the merger. So there's more cycles and more gravitational waves emitted. So this means that we are more sensitive to positive spins. We can see them to further distances. So even if the true distribution was symmetric, we expect to detect more positive spins. So in order to compensate for this, we can repeat the plot, but just putting a weight to each event that upweights the ones with a less sensitive volume and decreases the weight for the ones with positive volume, with a large volume, so that this count less than this. Still, you see that there's quite a lot of events with small chi effective, so this ratio is order one. But still, it's very well measured, so that you can exclude that it's zero. For these events, then the weights don't matter much, but there's no similar things happening on the negative side, which there's no good reason for this to happen if the distribution is symmetric.
It's not similar on the negative, you mean with small error bar?
Exactly, yeah. That's the argument. And then let me let's explore one extra question. So let's say we convince ourselves that there's more positive spins than negative. Is it possible that these spins are produced by tidal interactions? And this channel would be like that. In the isolated formation, it's expected that there would be a common envelope phase in which when one of the stars expands, it engulfs the other one. And this, which is typically already a black hole by this time, then this black hole finds itself in the envelope of the other star and deposits a lot of orbital energy into the envelope. The envelope gets ejected, and the orbit shrinks a lot. And if this process stops before the two things merge, then the outcome is that you have in a tight orbit a black hole and a star, and the core of a star, right? Now, after this, the aftermath is the following. The star will live for some time, and then it will become a black hole. And while it's a star, it is sensitive to tides from the black hole. And after it becomes a black hole, the black hole is tiny, so no more tides. And there's two then relevant distance scales for the problem. One is that if the things are too separated, they will never merge in the age of the universe by gravitational waves alone. So that sets one maximum distance. So LIGO only sees things to the left. And the other relevant distance scale is if the things are very close, tides are strong, and the star will get tidally locked to the black hole. There's some critical distance after which tides become weak. And they become weak with a very high power of the distance. So simplifying, you can think this is like a step function where it gets tidally locked, doesn't get tidally locked. And in the case that it gets tidally locked, the star is quite big compared to a black hole. So it has a lot of spin orbital angular momentum. Much more, like enough to make a maximally spinning black hole. So the simplest expectation from this would be that if it's to the left, then it would produce a maximally spinning aligned black hole for the secondary. Okay. Now there's complications to this model, so there are like other more complicated models with winds, and winds can change the mass. If the mass changes, the orbital separation changes. There's things you can, complications you can add to the story, and people have predicted them.
The star can be rotated, but when the supernova happens, this momentum, angular momentum star does not necessarily all go to the black hole, right?
That's also correct. And yeah, to my knowledge, this is not very well studied yet. Like, even if you have enough angular momentum in the star, I don't think it's a theorem that the black hole would be maximally spinning, but let's say it's like the simplest back of the envelope prediction. It's also, like, as I said, there are also other complications related to the evolution of this, but let me put it this way. This is the strongest model that we can constrain. Like, if everything happens as simple as possible, then you have this story where it's either non-spinning or maximally spinning with a line spin. And this is the model that makes the strongest prediction and the easiest to try to rule out. So in this spirit, then depending on whether, okay, this star was the primary or the secondary, that means the one that gives a heavier or lighter black hole, we can predict the value of effective spin as a function of the mass ratio only. And we can scale the effective spin by this quantity. So if it is the secondary that was tidally locked, the effective spin should be Q over 1 plus Q. So I divide by that. And those are the blue points. And the orange points are if the heavier one is the one that gets tidally locked. So under this simple model, then every black hole should be either have a zero, which means like the star was to the right here and didn't get tidally locked, or one for either the blue or the orange, right? And you see that, okay, this story works for most of the events, like these ones and these ones, but there's a few of them that in which both the blue and the orange are inconsistent with being zero or one. So this simple model cannot explain all the binary black holes. So of course, more complicated models in which these effects are milder may still be consistent.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. So orange means you have assumed the spin is zero?
That the black hole that is maximally spinning is the heavier one. So, you know, typically a more massive star would evolve faster and then it would form the first black hole. And then in this story, this would be the heavier one. However, there can be mass transfer. So it can be that what so if the heavier stars evolve faster, it becomes a giant faster, transfers mass to the other one, and then becomes a black hole. But then now the other one has all this extra mass and may form the heavier black hole. That's the like a complication of this channel.
Right, you are saying you
either have zero spin bubble or maximum spin bubble.
Yes.
How do you ask them on? So
well, but we have two black holes, right? So the prediction of this model, the prediction I'm testing is that either it's 0, 0, so this is the heavier one, and this is the lighter one, or it is 0, 1, this would be the normal case without mass transfer, or it would be 1, 0, this is with mass ratio reversal. It can even be 1, 1, if, you know, when common envelope happens, this guy is still a star, that can even happen. So this, four possibilities, if it in some event this is inconsistent with all four possibilities, then this model cannot explain all the black holes.
So yeah, maybe on the next slide one, right, the scaling scale with mass ratio, you get those if you just take the definition of chi effective and set one to zero. Then basically the spin of that black hole times one of those ratios, either q over one plus q. Like the spin of whatever object was spinning.
Oh.
And then the argument is that number should either be 0 or 1. Right, Javier?
Yeah.
Okay, but he has this 1 plus q divided by q times chi effective.
Right, so that's like chi effective or chi effective 0. So chi the actual chi effective divided by my prediction according to this. Could be 0, 1. Okay. Yeah, maybe I should make this slide clearer, but thanks. Good, and just to wrap up, let me, so up to this moment, I was just showing histograms and things we can look with our own eyes, but we can also do a similar thing with more machinery where we, include you know, properly the measurement errors and the sensitivity of the detector and the significance of these events. And then we try to invent some parameterized model for the distribution of chi-effective and constrain its parameters. And this model I will use is that there are three components. One, with the fractions zeta negative, 0 and positive, one then at 0, and one with negative chi effective, which is just a truncated Gaussian with some width, and a truncated Gaussian to the positive side with the same width. Good. Zeta 0 is 1 minus the other 2 by definition, so this has 3 parameters. And this is the result we get for the parameters. And there's two interesting conclusions. The first one is that the zeta positive seems to be bigger than zeta negative. So this is not a many sigma result by any means, but you see that if we draw the line of equal thing, this would be a symmetric distribution as predicted by globular clusters. And you see that most of the weight of the posterior is to the right, say, more positive events than negative. Of course, as I said, this tentative evidence for now.
Question: what would the Gaussian, the width of the Gaussian for both the positive and negative agree?
I just made this up so that if I set zeta positive equal to zeta negative, then the distribution is symmetric. Good. So this would disfavor the isotropic. The second interesting result is that the fraction of negative spins is consistent with being 0. It's possible that all the black holes have either 0 or positive spin. And
the fraction of the 0 spin consistent with 0 or not?
The fraction of 0 spins can be 0. So you see, yeah, that would be like this line here, the diagonal here. It can be 0 with some low probability. It's like, yeah. And I think, yeah, there was quite a lot of debate about this after this result. It can be zero, it can be as high as 60% or 70%, something like that. So you see. So, okay, this point here is the fraction equal to one, and you can see that it can be quite large. Like I said, if you just look with your eyes and fit this Gaussian here, you see that 2/3 of the events are consistent with zero speed.
Okay.
So that makes sense with that. Okay, so just to summarize, I introduced this coordinate system that is very good for parameter estimation because it removes degeneracies and multimodality. It has a simple Jacobian, so you can just as well use it for sampling. And it is inverted analytically. All these tricks have been implemented in this parameter estimation code that is called Cogwheel and publicly available. And regarding the spin distribution, there seems to be an excess of aligned spins over anti-aligned, and we find no evidence for anti-aligned spins in the population. So with that, thanks very much.
Any questions?
So apologies for a bit reductionistic, but the new coordinate system, right? One could think of that as just clever jump proposals in the original coordinate system.
Yeah.
Right? So is the reason why nice to actually sample the transform coordinates just because you can use samplers off the shelf and you don't have to plug in some careful detail balance, or is there anything deeper than?
All right, you can, so it's equivalent to jump proposals, I'm pretty sure, for MCMC, so Markov chain Monte Carlo sampling. However, there's other algorithms like nested sampling that are often used. I'm not sure if you can draw a parallelism to that. I would have to think about it. And then again, I guess also this folding I showed is also equivalent to some long jump proposals. And in fact, there are some of these symmetries are indeed implemented in, say, LAL inference. So for example, one of these bimodalities I discussed a bit was this one. So if you add pi to the orbital phase, you probably land on a good solution. This is used in LAL inference. This is one of the jump proposals of LAL inference. However, I also introduced these other symmetries. So if I change phi net hat to minus phi net hat with phi net hat is this modification of the azimuth in the sky location that I introduced. Anyways, these two coordinates, these two jumps, these are not in LAL inference. So you could implement jump proposals that do these symmetries, but they are just not there.
Thanks.
Any
other
last point? There is no evidence for the dynamical formation
channel. Right, so the conclusion would seem if you just look at the spin distribution, so there's two points that are not exactly the same, right? So one is there, okay, as I said, this is not many sigmas, but if you can establish that there's more positive events than negative, then this rules out that all the events come from dynamical formation, right? This rules out that all of them come from dynamical formation, otherwise the distribution would be symmetric. Now, if you also say, okay, isolated formation can never produce negative spins, this is not completely true, but let's just say for a second. and you establish that the population has a negative spin, then this would rule out, that would be the converse, rule out that all of them come from isolated. If you just look at the spins at this moment, we show that this is not the case, and the fraction of negative spins is consistent with zero, and then all the events are consistent with coming from isolated formation. Now this is just looking at the spins. Then there's problems also for the isolated formation. If you look at the masses, for example, some events are more massive than you would expect from isolated binary formation due to the dispar instability supernova gap. So stellar evolution predicts that usually the bigger the star is, the more massive the black hole will be. This holds until some point where if the star is too massive, in the core of the star, the temperature is hot enough that you can out of photons that are supporting the that are providing pressure to support the star, you can these thermal photons or the tail of the thermal photons are gamma rays can produce electron positrons, and then all these photons become electron positrons. The pressure drops, and the whole star collapses and then explodes. This supernova that's called perinstability supernova, it blows up the whole star and leaves no black hole. So there would be a maximum mass of the black hole that you can produce from a single star. If the star is much more massive, like 200 solar masses or above 200, you can produce a black hole again because this explosion is not enough to unbind the material. But then this black hole would be 100 and something solar masses. So there should be a gap between 40 and 100. And we do see events in this gap. And one potential explanation for these things that is the product of previous mergers. And so if you have two 40-40 solar mass black holes that merge, you have now 180 solar mass black hole that just didn't come from a star. But it has to merge again, right? It has to, the merger product has to merge again, and this cannot happen for an isolated binary star. But it can happen in dynamical environments. So that's like a whole different line of argument. Some evidence pointing that. But OK, in this talk, I just talk about the spins. And if you just look at the spins, there's no problem for the isolated
binary. So why do you choose the
Right. So, I think principal component only works if you already have samples of the data and then you want a good coordinate system to describe those samples. But in a similar spirit, you could also do a Fisher matrix. If you know what your model is, can go back to the likelihood function. So you write this likelihood function, you have a model for what is HK is the part that depends on the parameters. And then you can take derivatives and second derivatives of this likelihood function and find what the Fisher or the covariance of the distribution will be near the peak and peak coordinates in which this covariance is identity. This, in fact, has been done by another group for the intrinsic parameters with very good results. And we also had a student doing a similar thing. So the idea is instead of using, say, for the intrinsic parameters like chirp mass, mass ratio, and chi effective, these quantities, you can write instead of this some nonlinear combinations of these things that describe the post-Newtonian coefficients of the waveform that depends on these parameters. And you find the linear combinations of these coefficients that are orthogonal to each other, where with respect to orthogonal with an inner product that that is basically weighted by the detector noise. In that way, you can find good coordinates for these intrinsic parameters as well. And I would say at this point, this is work in progress for us, but it can be done. For the extrinsic parameters, in some cases, these transformations I introduced are nonlinear. For example, this one is nonlinear, and this one also involves some 3D rotation. Those are nonlinear, so their PCA just wouldn't work.
So this parameter chi b that is sometimes used to measure the misalignment of spins. So that parameter essentially takes two angles, theta 1 and theta 2, that are the angles between the spins and the angular momentum. And there was a paper, a few papers that proposed different parameters to measure this, like this generalized chi b, a paper by Davide Girosa and others. Yeah, so they showed that you need three angles because all three angles evolve at the same time scale. So here in your case, you essentially have two angles, right? The third is extrinsic related to the direction, right? So with only two angles, can you say for sure that there's no bias in your measurement for the misalignment, or do you need the third angle?
I see. So just to clarify, there's no approximation made in this, in the sense that it's just a coordinate change. So I have as many coordinates as I had before. It's a complete system of 15 parameters. It's just describing the same distribution in a different system of coordinates. So this. The choice of intrinsic of the system of coordinates is inspired by, say, the post-Newtonian approximation or the single detector or some approximations. However, this is just to come up with the coordinate change, but then the coordinate change is just the coordinate change. There's no approximation there. I'm not assuming that the things depend on less parameters. And okay. Then regarding the KP. So indeed, this precession is very interesting, as I said, for astrophysical interpretation. So there was a lot of work in finding parametrizations of precession. And I think the one that we found, at least to me, was more successful in the sense that we found this parameter that is very well constrained and we just didn't expect. So we were discussing just before the talk, but if you think this is just a coordinate change, you're not gaining any new information. It's just plotting the samples in a different way, but it's the same samples. However, we didn't expect that this parameter was being measured at all. It was already being measured, but if you don't have the correct projection to look at the samples, then you may not even realize that you're measuring some parameter. And I think this was the case for this spin azimuth. Whereas for the KP, it's rarely the case that KP gets meaningfully measured. Furthermore, the motivation for KP, I think, is for modeling the signal, in that KP just contains intrinsic parameters. Right? It just contains the angles between the spins and the spins' magnitudes without regard to where the detector is located. But the way that the data can constrain the spins is through these amplitude modulations. And these amplitude modulations, where they happen, depends on where the detector is located. So we found that by putting the detector location in our parametrization of the spins, we could better see this effect.
Yeah. Questions? If not, let's send a